We must understand clearly when we talk about capitalism, who are the capitalists? As if we understand that there are only a few people who own and control the means of production in the society, then we begin to understand that there are a few capitalists. And these capitalists exploit everybody because everybody works for them. Everybody sells their labor to them. It is by selling your labor to a capitalist that he's really able to exploit you. Instead of going through theories, let me give some direct example. Let's say that I'm a capitalist. Let's say that I sell shirts. I have a shirt factory. Let's say this is my factory. I own it. The machinery. I have a place where I get cotton. Now, I own it. I'm the capitalist. Let's say you are my workers. You are my workers. You don't know me. You never see me. You see my lackeys, you know, maybe my foreman, but you never see me. Now, let's say it costs me 50 cents for cotton for every shirt I make. And let's say it costs me 50 cents for upkeep of my machinery. That's a dollar. And let's suppose I pay you a dollar for every shirt you make. That means it costs me $2 to get a shirt, labor included, your labor. I pay you for making the shirt. Now, when I sell the shirt, being a capitalist, and you must know something about capitalism, very important. The sole motivating force in a capitalist society is profit. Profit. That is the sole motivating force. Profit. Get money. Get it. Get it as fast as you can. Get it any way you can, but get it. Just get it. Just get it. And even in the African community, this it affects us here in this country because Africans, those of us living in America, those of us born in America, we are imbued with the philosophy of capitalism, and sometimes we don't even recognize it. Thus, you find brothers and sisters even selling dope to their brothers and sisters to make money. Again, because we're imbued with the philosophy of get some money. Ain't nothing wrong to kill for money. Hell, your country is napalming for money. You can certainly kill for some money. All right, just get it. Just get it. It's the overall philosophy. When we talk about revolution, we must talk about changing values. We must talk about changing values, and we must understand these values. To the shirt factory. I've not forgotten. I'm just going to tie it in. I'll tie it in for you. I'll tie it in. You will see, you must look under the shirt factory, too. You must look for spiraling economy. That's very important, spiraling economy. I sell the shirt for $5. I sell the shirt for $5. I don't do anything. You're the one who make the shirt. I'm exploiting your labor. You toil, you sweat, I get the fruit. That's right, I get it. But you grow it, you plant it by the sweat of your brow. I get it. I sell the shirt for $5. I am exploiting your labor. I really am exploiting your labor. I mean, even when you want a shirt, hey, you gotta come to my store and buy the shirt for $5. Hey, I really am exploiting you. Now, you're workers, you're in a factory, so you begin to get social consciousness. Yes, you do. Marx talks about this. Because you're working together, you see the socialized process, the laboring process, and you're able to see clearly how you're being exploited. So you get together, and you start talking about, we want more money. You tell my foreman we want more money. So the foreman comes to see me. He says, the workers say they want more money. Later for them. Keep them working, man. So he comes back, no raise. You all work, but you all get a little bit more agitated, you know, because it's scientific. The pressure rises, and as the pressure rises, the consciousness must rise. It's scientific. It can't be stopped. That's why revolution can't be stopped. Then you say, hey, look here. We're going to strike. So the foreman comes back and said, hey, they say they're going to strike. I say, oh, let them strike, man. And sure enough, you all strike. Yeah, you all strike on me. Now, when you strike, of course, my machinery stops. I ain't making no money. So after a while, I called my foreman. I said, what do they want? He says, well, they said they want $1.50 more a shirt. They want 50 cents more a shirt. So I said, okay, let them have it. So I'll bring you back. You happy? I pay you $1.50 more. Right, so it now costs me $2.50 to make a shirt. It cost me $2.50 to make a shirt. Before, it cost me $2. I was selling it for $5. But hey, look here. I can't go out there and keep selling it for $5. Hey, how am I going to do that? I'm going to lose profit. And look here, since the sole motivating force in a capitalist system is profit, ain't no need for me to come and sell it for $5.50. Hey, no. Next time you see that shirt on the market, it's going to cost you $7.50. Right. Right. And that's what's known as the spiraling economy. Because profit is what about wages go up into demands of the workers and prices rocket. Wages go up, prices rocket. And it keeps going and going and going until it's got to blow the top. It's scientifically real. That's why Nixon is talking about freezing wages and freezing prices. He's stupid. You got to freeze capitalism, Nixon. Freeze capitalism. That's a problem. That's a problem. Yes, that's a problem. You must understand these concepts, because once you begin to understand them and master them, you will see the inevitability of revolution. Not only the inevitability of revolution, but you will see the inevitability of victory for the struggling masses around the world once you understand the scientific principles of revolution. Once you understand it.
In 1968, J. Edgar Hoover, then the head of the FBI, called the Black Panthers the single greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. Armed and militant, they said that racism would not end without violence. Joining me now are one former Black Panther, Elaine Brown. She became the Panthers' leader in 1974, and she has just written a memoir of that time called A Taste of Power. Also joining me, Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael. He has recently updated his book, Black Power. You remember the slogan, Black Power, with him when he was one of the leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Why, your memory's excellent.
Yes, I do remember that. That was my time. Let me start with Elaine first, because let me just review where some of the people that were part of I assume like we could say, the revolution that both of you were part of, the protests that you were part of, the militants you were part of. Huey Newton, dead.
Yes.
Shot in a drug deal or something in
Oakland. Well,
he Oakland.
Was killed on the streets of Oakland.
Killed on the streets of Oakland. Yes. H. Rapp Brown is where, your colleague?
He's in Atlanta, Georgia.
Doing what?
He's a Muslim. He's the head of a mosque there. He has the name now. Amin El Amin.
Yeah. Do you two know, stay in touch, talk,
oh, yes, oh,
friends?
Yes, we talk all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Eldridge Cleaver.
He's in the Oakland area, yeah. I believe.
He's not of the same faith that you are anymore, is he?
No.
He's in Oakland.
I don't know what he is doing exactly. I read an article about him not that long ago, but I don't know exactly what he's doing.
And Kathleen Cleaver went to Yale Law School, and
yes,
she's
and
where?
I think she's a professor now at a law school, yeah. But I'm not sure where. I thought
Atlanta.
It was Emory.
It's not Emory? Yeah.
I thought it was Emory.
I think I remember. Yeah. And Fred Hampton was killed in Chicago by the police, shot in the head. Who am I missing? There is also, who was the young man who was, I think, may have been the defense minister, but was just elected to Congress?
Bobby Rush.
Bobby Rush.
Chicago.
Out of
yes.
Chicago,
yes.
Just elected to
Congress. Yes.
Yeah. Did you think you'd ever see a member of the Black Panthers elected to the Congress of the United States when you were in the midst of the action you were engaged in?
Well, certainly. Ron Dellums went to the Congress.
Of course,
everybody
Ron
thought
Dellums,
he was a Black Panther.
He's been there a long time and may be chairman of the Defense of the Armed Services Committee of the House.
Not totally inconsistent with what we thought.
Yeah. Yeah. And you now, you've written this memoir.
Yes.
And you talk about the time when Huey Newton was going to Cuba to escape. And you were left to keep the party together.
Yes, I was. Yeah. Kind of phenomenal when you consider that I was a woman and am a woman.
Yeah. Tell me about it. I mean, your thoughts then and what it was and what you want us to appreciate about your own experiences.
In terms of the Black Panther Party?
Yeah, well, in terms of what you wrote about.
Well, I think in terms of the assumption of power and of the Black Panther Party, in terms of the leadership, because at that point, the leadership had been really reduced to one man. That was Huey Newton.
Right.
That was the reality. Now, one of the things you didn't mention is that formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture was at one point the prime minister of the Black Panther Party coming out of SNCC, and there was an affiliation and association. So
right.
There was a mixture of those two tendencies, one could say.
Right.
But as far as the Black Panther Party was concerned, the so-called militant part, the armed part, had moved into another phase. J. Edgar Hoover actually stated that the reason that the Panther Party was dangerous was not the few little guns we had, he said, with so much machoism, but the fact that we were spreading our propaganda throughout the community, that is to say, to take control of one's destiny, and ultimately our goal being not the overthrow as much of the United States government, but the complete change of the scheme of things. So when I took control as such of the Black Panther Party, it was my goal to simply continue that program. And at that point, the specifics of that were was to the specific point was to control one specific arena, that being the city of Oakland, including, as I like to say, port, stock, and barrel, the operative word being port, to control the economics and to create a kind of socialist model in one city.
How have you changed in your own agenda and in your own political philosophy?
Not very much, other than in terms of strategy. I maintain the same ideological principles that I did in the Black Panther Party. It was the party that shaped me. The mistakes that we made, I reviewed. I tried to review. And the good things that we did, I also tried to review. But in terms of my fundamental principles, I am essentially the same person.
Yeah. Let me go now to Kwamenturi. Tell me about your own evolution from that time now. And I mean, I read the foreword written in 1992 to your book. What happened between that time and now for you? Because I know you went to Ghana for a while.
I'm still there. I still live in Guinea.
Yeah.
Yes. I've been in Africa since then. I've been living there. And my position, of course, has not changed any, you know, that's to say, none of the ideological aspects have changed, like Elaine. I've become more knowledgeable, more experienced, and more determined to arrive at the objective of the liberation of my people. It is clear with the struggle that the only solution now is Pan-Africanism.
But that was a solution that I remember you advocating at the time, wasn't it?
Yes, and I'm still, that's why at least I'm consistent. It's one of the prerequisites for truth. It doesn't mean you could be consistently incorrect, but at least you must be consistent. And as I learned a long time ago, it's a prerequisite for truth, so I'm consistent. Yeah. It's the only solution, so I've not changed. My strategy is the mass organization of our people to transform the mass movement of the 1960s to mass organization. Yeah. Has been the central task.
And many people watching this, and I would say to you too, history has gone somewhere else. And it is now with when you look at the number of African Americans, you know, who are participating in the Clinton administration in positions of power in the president's cabinet, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is a black man and an African American, and a whole sense of while all the problems remain and the disparities in income distribution and all of that, there is, in a sense, a continued growth in political participation and in the assumption of power, especially at the local level and the state level, and more so in the national level, in the political arena. And therefore, the kinds of ideas that you're articulating don't have the resonance that they used to.
Well, I would not agree at all.
Let us take Los Angeles. Los Angeles example.
The great example.
In 1965, there was a rebellion in Watts.
Right.
In 1992, there was a rebellion in Los Angeles. Right. In 1965, none of the things that you've just advocated were true. In 1965, Sam Yorty was mayor. We had no mayors. In 1992, Tom Bradley is a mayor.
Right.
In 1965, we had no mayors to speak of. In 1992, Africans in America have over 300 mayors in the country. But all of these changes...
Detroit and Atlanta, some of them,
the biggest
New
cities,
York.
Biggest cities in all
biggest cities.
Biggest cities in the country.
Right.
And we have now some 7,000 elected officials. As a matter of fact, Africans in America have more elected officials than any other ethnic group in the country. And yet, we have no power at all. So all of these changes have been...
But
just,
how would you define no power, then?
I'm coming to show you no power. The fact that the conditions of life of the mass of our people are worse today in Los Angeles than they were in 1965 show that we have no power. We have a lot of visibility. Jesse Jackson, seen all over television, he has no power at all. None whatsoever. So they give us visibility, but no power. So the conditions of the masses, because there's no power, becomes worse, not better.
But I don't think Kurt Smoke would say he has no power, the mayor of Baltimore.
He has no power.
Why would you say he has no power?
Well, let me talk about that.
Okay, but wait, let me just tell you, I'll come right to it. Why would you say he has no power? He's the mayor of Baltimore. I mean, he's trying to do things to affect not only African-Americans, but other Americans in Baltimore.
I'll tell you why
he has
no power.
And he has more power than...
I'll tell you why he has no power.
Okay.
For us, power can come only from our organized masses. All of our power to bring change in this country come from mass struggle. That's clear.
So if the power comes from mass struggle, it is clear to change things, political power can only come from the organized masses to ensure those changes. And since the masses of our people are not organized, he can have no power at all. None whatsoever. If he does, where's his power base? It certainly is not the mass of his people. And if it's not the masses of his people, the power base must be used against his people.
Lane.
Well, I go back to a fundamental analysis in terms of economics and in terms of the distribution in America. And the bottom line is you have David Dinkins in New York. You have Tom Bradley. I'm not even speaking about their sentiments.
Because Sharon Pratt Kelly in Washington.
And there's a big Sharon Pratt in Washington and so forth. But the reality is that the power doesn't necessarily exist within the government in the United States. The military power certainly exists at the national level, but in the day-to-day business of the city of New York doesn't necessarily have its power base in terms of economics within the mayor's office. David Dinkins cannot wave a wand and make the make Harlem into the suburbs, as everybody, I'm using that as a sure. as an image. The bottom line, as far as I am concerned, is the economic distribution. And so the fact that black people in general, black people living in the United States of America, or as Kwame says, Africans living in America, have no power base whatsoever. The putting a black face, I mean, it would be like saying you could put a kente cloth on Clarence Thomas and all of a sudden he would be a black man. So my position is simply that you can't dress this up by putting a certain faces. This doesn't mean that it isn't interesting. It doesn't mean that there hasn't been some change. It only means that that change hasn't been fundamental. Because the reality is that there is poverty, tremendous poverty and tremendous disparity as to whites and blacks generally.
We just talked about the fact with a previous guest that one out of four children born in America today is born in below the poverty line.
He said some very heavy things in his quiet voice, didn't he?
Yes, he did. But it seems to me that, and I'm the first to acknowledge, as I think most people do when they look at the society and they look at L.A. and they look at other places and acknowledge racism that is in our cities and in our country. At the same time, a lot of the kinds of poverty is impacting on a lot of white people as well.
Absolutely.
You know, and the inability of the social system. And the inability, not of the system, the inability of the leadership to affect change in the lives of those people, you know, is taking place across racial lines. I mean, David Dinkins can't do it for black Americans or white Americans either in terms of what he wants to do with respect to welfare because of budgetary crisis and other kinds of crisis.
I don't think so. I think it's simply...
You don't think it's because of that? You think it's more...
No, it's simply a question of... reallocating the money.
Cut
the defense budget from 100%, you'll have enough money to feed everybody in America.
But you wouldn't advocate that, would you?
Why not?
Cutting the defense budget by 100%?
My Martin Luther King would be proud of that.
I bet you he wouldn't.
I bet he would be.
I bet he wouldn't be. 100%?
100%.
Now, Thurgood Marshall just died, you know, who was an important figure in the civil rights of our country. I mean, I never heard him advocate something like
Well, you know, Thurgood Marshall is a good man, but we have different positions here.
Yeah, okay. But Ron Dellums is not advocating that. Even Ron Dellums is not advocating cutting the defense budget by 100%, and you know that's true.
He's advocating more than 50%.
He's advocating more than Les Aspin, his predecessor,
right,
and now Secretary of Defense is.
But I think the fundamental issue is exactly that. It's a question of distribution. A lot can be done. It's not difficult. The Port of New York or Port Authority of New York is the single largest port in the world, as I believe.
Right. I assume it is. I don't know.
But yet we have Harlem and people dying of AIDS in Harlem.
Yeah.
And people die, and black children, infant mortality rate 50% higher than white children in America. In America. People hungry, walking on the street, walk outside, look around the street. Yet we have all these millions and, in fact, billions of dollars coming into just the Port of New York.
And what you were saying.
Where is that money?
And where is that money?
Where is it? That's the question. Is it in David Dinkins' hands? No, it's sitting somewhere. So it's a question of, as Kwame suggests, a question of the will to distribute. For example, I certainly thought that Clinton was better than Bush.
Sure.
I consider him to be not Bush. And this means only the question of lifting one's head and getting a quick breather for a minute. But, I mean, I would call on Clinton, for example, to simply issue an apology on behalf of the United States government for the 400 years of chattel slavery. I would call on Clinton or anyone else to say, just give us, just lead out with some principles. Black people are talking about reparations now, reparations for Jews in Germany, reparations for Japanese. I mean, these are crimes that have been committed. So that's a simple...
Are you calling for reparations?
Well, we discussed this tonight. I mean, there's some qualification to that, but
we,
in
meaning you and Wami, or
no, I listened to what was discussed tonight. Yeah. I would certainly agree that there has to be a qualified discussion, a discussion about this in terms of qualifying what we mean by it. But in principle, yes. I mean, we have a Vietnam War memorial in the city of Washington, D.C. to heal the wounds of Vietnam.
The most visited memorial in the city.
But we have not even talked about healing the wound. We have not even addressed the wound of 400 years of chattel slavery, or the fact that between 1865 and 1964, there wasn't really a law that said black people were, in fact, citizens of the United States of America. And whatever I might think about that law, the point is that has not been addressed in principle at the highest levels of government. So it's not going to make that much difference if you put Ron Brown here or Aretha Franklin on the stage if the majority of black people in America are living in a relative poverty.
Let me talk about the point that you... What did you think of Malcolm X? Were you critical of the film?
Great. Huh? I didn't see the, film. No, no, I'm sorry.
No, I knew Malcolm X was a,
no,
was
I cannot
a
see
hero
the film.
To you.
I cannot see the film.
Why
I mean,
not?
The film cannot teach me anything. Anyway, to make a film about Malcolm X, do you know what you have to know?
What do you have to know?
To know, to make a film about Malcolm X, you at least have to read the Quran. Know it from cover to cover. Understand its force.
Have you done that?
Of course. To know, to make a film
about... Have you done that,
Elaine? Yeah. No, I haven't.
I have read the Quran. I've read the Torah. I read the Book of Certitude. I've read the two volumes of Nishirin Deoshonin.
And the
I've read
Bible,
the Bible
from cover to cover.
Of course. I've read the Bible from cover to cover many times, and I've read it in jail several times. I read all religious books. I have to. If these books are affecting these many people, I got to deal with
them. And you think religion is the answer?
No, that's not the issue. That's not the issue. I'm a revolutionary, that's clear. Yeah. Religion has to incorporate the struggle. But it's not the sole answer in this instance. It's clear. If that's were the case, we would be free because Africans are the most religious people in the world, just about. So it's clear that that is not the issue itself. But to make a film on Malcolm X, you have to know Pan-Africanism. You have to know the life of the Honorable Marcus Garvey. You have to know his organization, the Universal Negro Improvement
Association. Do you really have to know all that to make a film about Malcolm X?
Yes, you do have to know that. His father was a member of that organization. That organization led directly into the Organization of the Nation of Islam with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. You have to know that.
And Spike Lee, in your judgment, didn't know that?
Because he cannot know that. He doesn't even look that way.
And all the people that he talked to and all the research he did and following the autobiography that Alex Haley wrote was not enough.
The film cannot teach anyone who knows something about Malcolm X. It's someone who knows nothing about Malcolm X can see the film and be inspired to now learn about Malcolm X.
Did you see the film?
No, I haven't seen it.
For the same reason or for another reason?
Not for the same reason.
You just haven't had a chance to watch many movies lately? Or?
No, I haven't been in the United States very long.
You're living in Paris, aren't
I'm
you?
I'm living in France.
In south of France, or you don't want to know? Or
well, I'm living in three places in France, as a matter of fact.
Because, are you... you
Vous parlez français?
Because you prefer Europe to the United States, or
no,
just
because
personal
I happen
reasons?
To be there, and it makes me very happy not to be in the United States.
To be here makes you happy?
No, it makes me very happy not to be in the United States.
Because... What?
But that's my personal life. I mean, it doesn't make me happy that the conditions are here, but I have the opportunity to not be here, and so it's a question of, you know...
Why did you write the book at this time?
I took 8 years to write that book. I wrote the book for personal reasons and for political reasons. I wrote the book, one, to open the wounds and heal the wounds, my own
I'm
and those.
I'm out of time. I'm sorry I have to stop here. I thank you for coming. Thank you very much.
Well, we thank you. It was good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Be with us tomorrow for a conversation with the Israeli ambassador to the United States. Also, A Few Good Men screenwriter Aaron Sorkin. Good night.
Next tonight, we look at one of the most vigorous internal debates in the black community in the past two decades. It's the issue of changing from black to African American. It had only been 22 years since the last major name change had occurred. It happened just after a white racist shot James Meredith, the first black graduate of Ole Miss. The shooting occurred on a southern highway as Meredith was leading a voter registration march from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi. It so enraged student activist Stokely Carmichael that as he emerged from a Greenwood, Mississippi jail where he had been held for his voter registration work, the first words to emerge from his mouth were, "Black power." It was the beginning of a major new phase in black confidence and self-assertion that captured the imagination and stirred the consciousness of black people all over the world. Now, according to some polls, a majority of black people have said they prefer the term African American. But the issue is far from settled.
I prefer to be called African American because African American reflects the true nature of my cultural heritage.
And I think it's better for you to be called black. What's wrong with that? It's different black. It's black Africans. It's black West Indians, you know? Black is beautiful. That's what I have to say.
I'm an American, whether I'm a black American or what, don't make any difference. I'm just an American.
You had Dukakis in the election. They kept calling him Greek American. So being that every black person over here has African heritage, you know, we should be called African American.
Editorials in both black and white publications generally supported the call to use African American. The New York Times called it healthy archaeology, arguing that blacks may now feel comfortable enough in their standing as citizens to adopt the family surname American, and their first name, African, conveys a pride in cultural heritage that all Americans cherish. Said the Chicago Defender, as the world continues to shrink, Americans who speak to their Africanness with the African American title will likely find the cultural, education, and economic relationship with others much smoother. Opinion also varied among the guests we interviewed in our special Black History Month series.
I always thought that Afro-American or African-American was the appropriate designation. And there is some beneficial effects in acknowledging the reality, the African heritage and the American presence. But that's not the critical issue. The critical issue is gaining power.
I believe that it is important for us as a people to think that we are connected to the world, because the African diaspora was for real. We were sent to different parts of the world.
Well, naturally, it's our heritage. But all of us here are really educated and exposed to American life. So is that we really are, we have to dig back. For this ancestry. I mean, I'm not an African.
It's a very complicated question. So rather than argue over it, let's not give up black, let's not give up African. So in all the work that I do, the essays I write, I use both interchangeably.
For more on the story, we turn now to four other people with different views. Kwame Ture is an organizer with the All African People's Revolutionary Party, a group attempting to politically unite African people living in 113 countries all over the world. It was his call for black power in 1966, when he was known as Stokely Carmichael, that catapulted the term black into popular usage. Leon Winter is a copy editor for the Wall Street Journal, and last week wrote an article that appeared on the journal's op-ed page called "This African American Still Feels Black." J. Bruce Llewellyn is a businessman who owns the eighth largest Coca-Cola bottling company in the country. He also owns television station WKBW, an ABC affiliate in Buffalo. Ramona Edlin is president of the National Urban Coalition. She proposed the name change at the Chicago meeting of black leaders last December. And to you, Ms. Edlin, the current initiative is largely your brainchild. Why is it important to use that term and not black?
Charlene, we have an opportunity to renew values such as mastery and learning, the importance of the family, unity, which is of the utmost importance right now. At a time when our children couldn't be in more distress and turmoil, when we face a new century, and it's up to us to be sure that the problem of the 21st century is not also the problem of the color line, as Du Bois prophesied in 1903 this century would be.
But how does African American affect all of that?
Well, we see, going back to African cultural ties to the land base that is our mother, as crucial in this process. And what I'm hoping is that we can recreate some of the spirit of the movement years, particularly for the children, by going back to values which were stripped systematically from us, as we all know, when we were enslaved for 250 years in this nation.
Mr. Winter, you don't want to change from black.
No. Well, I don't disagree that it is important for us to be cognizant of where we come from and the depth of our history that began before slavery. I just don't see the particular need in calling for renewal of the movement to leapfrog over the 400 odd years of history and of proud accomplishments that we can point to and indeed need to reacquaint our children with here in this country first. So I believe that it is important to teach the children and to, in general, imbue Black America with a knowledge of where it comes from, but to focus this effort on claiming what is ours here as Americans, which is the country that we are citizens of and where we pay our taxes.
Mr. Llewellyn, you prefer the term American.
Well, I guess in my all of my years on this earth, I've been called about five or six different things. I've been called black. I've been called Afro-American. Now we're talking about African-American. I've been called Negro. I've been called colored. And what strikes me as a continuous theme or theorem in all of this is the fact that we never have been called full citizens of the United States of America. And what I'd like to see accomplished once and for all is that we are considered as full citizens and have all the rights and privileges there too. All I see is that people in Russia, people in Poland, people in Nicaragua are all packing their bags and heading for the United States of America, feeling it's some kind of panacea or a great place to be, and there must be something here that brings all these people. All I'm saying to you is that I think it's a disgrace that we have been here for well over 200 years and we have not enjoyed these full benefits that a lot of people have come here generation after generation and gotten. And I think that's the key. That's where we ought to go. I'll be very honest with you. If I had my druthers, I wouldn't be worrying so much about whether you call me African-American or not. I would like very much to see throughout this country, as other groups have put in museums called Holocaust, to see slavery museums, museums which would show our suffering, our contribution over the years up until the year 1989 as to what we have done to give something to America. I think to try and leapfrog back and take youngsters in 1989 and tell them about our agrarian background in Africa is almost impossible at this point in time. The other problem with this is I listened to one gentleman on the thing say, well, during the campaign, we talked about Michael Dukakis as being a Greek American. Well, Greek American pinpoints a country called Greece. African American does not pinpoint any country. It is a continent. And therefore, either you're going to play a game called European American or African American, or otherwise, again, we still haven't been able to refine ourselves down to where we come from, whether we come from Nigeria or Kenya.
All right. Well, let me just go to Mr. Touré here. In the 1960s, as I said before, you were one of the ardent proponents of using the term black. How do you feel now about abandoning it in favor of African American?
Well, I do not even use the term African American. I use the term Africans because that's what we are. We are Africans in America. There's nothing American about us. Our history has only been a history of struggle in America. We are the only ethnic group in America who have to shed our blood to make reform. To get the vote, we must shed our blood. To get our children to school, we must shed our blood. To get on a bus and sit where we want, we must shed our blood. To even get in a filthy 5- and 10-cent store, we must shed our blood. So I don't see how we could be American. We're Africans in America struggling against American capitalism. And only until it's destroyed will we enjoy the rights that everyone else is speaking of.
Well, how do you respond to that, Mr. Llewellyn?
Well, what he's trying to do is to change the name of the game or change the rules. And I haven't got time to change the rules. I've got to look at what is. I guess I'm more practical about this. Maybe the ideal panacea is to change the rules and make it all a kind of a equal socialistic state. But in the meantime, let's talk about what is. This is a capitalistic society. We are here. We are paying our taxes. We are doing work each and every day. And I think we have the right to participate. We have sent people to war since the revolutionary times and spilled our blood for America, from Crispus Attucks and the Revolutionary War all the way down through this Vietnam. So therefore, I want to get what you can construe as my piece of the action like everybody else has gotten. And it really annoys me to see people who haven't made this kind of contribution over the years come here and feel that they can claim it and get it. And we have done that.
You have a response to that?
Of course. In the first place, just because we're in the capitalist system doesn't mean we must love it. We were made slaves. It doesn't mean that while you're a slave, you must love slavery. A conscious slave, while picking cotton on the plantation, is thinking about how to escape, how to bring freedom. Therefore, just because we're in capitalism doesn't mean we enjoy it. We have to fight for an equal society. That's our history. Our people show that we spill blood instinctively to advance humanity. And we have this responsibility to advance America, yes, to a socialist state.
You would seem to imply from your comment that capitalism is utterly inconsistent with Africa and Africans.
It is.
But I would posit that that's not true. If you look again at the nations of Africa, if you look at African people in every country of the world, especially in recent times, they essentially want things. They want products. They want the things that it's, at least up to this point, demonstrated that only capitalism, with its imperfections and with its inequities, which hopefully some people believe can still be tamed, people want things. And I don't somehow see a worldwide Pan-Africanism as also spelling the death knell for capitalism at the same time. It seems inconsistent. There are too many people who want cars in Lagos, Nigeria, last time I checked. The traffic jams are horrendous.
I don't think we can solve that one right now. But let me just go back to Ramona Edlin, because both Mr. Winter and Mr. Llewellyn talked about how they don't think it's possible to leapfrog over a lot of history and go back. It's impossible to go back to the agrarian life, that you can't even pinpoint a place in Africa where black people come from, if I'm paraphrasing your comments correctly. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, our culture and heritage in Africa entail far more than agrarian economies. Mathematics and science were born in Africa, philosophy and religion. And as well as that, we've been accomplished musicians and dancers for centuries. There's so much in our cultural heritage that we need to recoup right now, particularly for the children. And it is possible to leapfrog, as they put it. As a matter of fact, it's not only possible, it's necessary. Because if you begin with slavery, then you will still have children looking in your eyes as they do in mine, in our cities and in the streets, and saying, what difference does it really make to you, to me, or to anyone else, whether I live or die, whether I take drugs, whether I kill another person, whether I learn anything in school? We have a responsibility. And I think that one way we can have a cultural renaissance is to identify with a land base that gave us the wonderful things about our nature and our culture.
Mr. Llewellyn?
Well, that all sounds very nice and wonderful, but I invite you to take a look at Africa right now and today, and look at the situation in Eritrea against Ethiopia and all the other things that have happened, Biafra with the Nigerians and what have you. That, in my opinion, is idealistic and not the gut of the problem. The gut of the problem is something called values. The gut of the problem is something called family. The gut of the problem is something called importance. What do we construe and believe to be important?
I would submit that without a cultural offensive, without our unifying at this particular time and saying what we believe in and who we are and how we will train our children and what our families mean to us, that we will continue to have those same gut issues. That's precisely the point. We will continue unless we develop a cultural vehicle which will move us forward. All groups move forward by strength of their culture. It is a myth that individuals move forward. And certainly we cannot accept two or three of our group emerging year after year while the vast masses of us continue to go down. We have a responsibility.
Let me raise a point back to you, Kwame Ture. When you launched this move that resulted in black being adopted as the defining symbol for African-American people, many people felt that it helped to purge them of all the negative feelings about themselves, that it really represented the first major psychological break. And you heard the woman in the tape talk about black is beautiful. I mean, that was the most positive affirmation of blackness by black people. What do you say to people now who say you simply cannot abandon the term that came to symbolize so much for black people?
Human progress does not stand still. It moves. We came here as Africans. One of the first organizations we had fighting for us is known as the Free African Society. The very first independent organization we had in this country was the church. it was known as the African Methodist Episcopalian Church. So from Africans, our oppressor has changed us to colored, to Negro, to this, to that. We understand it's a step. Coming to black had a powerful point, because the point was that we were oppressed because of this color of our skin, and this was racism. But this fight is not just a fight over the color of our skin. A fight for power is a fight for land. When Mr. Llewellyn speaks about power, he's talking about land. Our land is Africa. America's not our land. It belongs to the American Indians. And we have a right to stand and take a moral struggle with them. And we don't worry about people being for things. People want things is incorrect. The point is not to explain the world. The point is to change it. Mr. If the people want material things, then we have a responsibility to tell them the things more important than material things, like freedom.
Mr. Winter?
Well, I can't claim to have been there, indeed, when black was coined, because I was somewhere in high school and I was on the listening end as, indeed, you were doing the talking. But it's always been my feeling that black was more than the recognition of where our blood comes from. It has a lot to do with the experience of people of color in a larger sense under colonialism, whether it was external colonialism, let's say in the Caribbean, or the internal colonialism that we had to deal with here in the United States, rather than simply a statement of Africa. Because the fact is, we have become more than simply descendants of Africa. We have created a lot of what America is in our own image. When you talk about this cultural-based offensive, I would rather see us claim American culture, which is not European culture. America does not mean white. American doesn't mean white. It means a combination of European and African and Asian and the rest of the cultures of the whole world. This is what America is. And if it denies the fact of what is African within it, then it is up to us to continue to assert that no, America does not mean white. America means a melting and a combination of things.
I think that's the point. We are saying African and American, and not everyone is willing to say American, and not everyone is willing to say African. But the point is, we are trying to merge the two, and American society at this point in time does exclude the African reality. America is an African as well as a European invention. Well, we know that, but it isn't accepted widely as now.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Eland. What is wrong? Hakeem Madhubuti said a few moments ago that in his writing and everything, he's going to use both. I mean, is there a problem with using African American for those who choose to, and for those who choose to use black, to use black?
No, I think we all will use both to a certain extent. First of all, it's going to be hard to break old habits that were very dear to us, and I certainly was along with Stokely in the days when the name was changed. But it is important to continue to draw the consciousness of our people to a set of values which were positive and productive for us. To call our mother's name is Africa. We are children without her if we leave that out, and I think that it's fair to say no one of us is satisfied with the status quo today.
Well, it seems that Time Magazine, in fact, has a piece on this week, and it says that for more than a century, descendants of freedmen have debated what name they should bear as a people. And in every instance, the shift in the change of appellation coincided with a new phase in the struggle for equality. Is that what's going on now, in your view? And what stage is this?
Yes, and I think this is a point of evolution in our culture. And it's the stage right before we cross the threshold to the 21st century. I think we are saying that there's a quickening of our will. We will not cross the threshold of the 21st century in the condition that we are today.
All right, let me ask Mr. Winter, what do you think about that?
I don't necessarily see this as a quickening, if you will, in that kind of direction. It seems to me that a move like this is an attempt more at a rhetorical assertion to sort of put a new name on things. But I don't see where it quite takes us to getting a better handle on what is immediately in front of us.
Maybe I should say, Charlene, that the cultural offensive is going to entail agenda setting, goal setting, working together to achieve our purposes. As you well know, Charlene, in the movement years, when you decided to desegregate the University of Georgia along with Hamp, We were unified around your decision. We were purposeful. We were powerful. There was a sense of destiny, and we achieved our goals. What we are so sadly lacking now is any sense of purpose or destiny. We are not setting agendas. We are not working together, though we're working very hard.
But is that because we don't have the right name?
Well, the name change is the first step in what we hope will be a self-conscious examination of our culture, going back to our ancient as well as our contemporary strengths, and pulling together a vehicle which will be more useful to us than the one that we are now engaged in. If anyone is satisfied with the status quo, I'm not aware of it, particularly our children.
Mr. Llewellyn, just very briefly, do you see this as a critical stage in the evolution of...
I swear, I do not know why people keep talking about what the container is called. It's what's the content of the container. This won't get us into the 21st century unless our kids can read, write, compute, and be able to compete in this country to make a living and to make progress. If that doesn't take place, we can put African American on them, we can put Negro on them, we can put anything you want to put on them, but they're not going to play the game in the 21st century because the field is getting tougher and tougher, and this not a level field.
Wait, just a minute. We're about to run out of time. Mr. Ture, a final comment on that point.
The error of the thinking here is that most people think that Africans in America came here just like other immigrant groups did. All other immigrants came to America expecting a better way of life. We started in hell, which was a slave ship, and we're still in hell. This incorrect assumption makes it appear as if we've made a contribution with our culture. Our culture has been trampled upon, not the others. Any contribution we've made to America is the test of the strength of our culture in spite of this oppression. We are Africans, and that's exactly where we're going.
Is the term, in your view, is that where you end it? Is that where it stops?
The content was African. The label has been changed to confuse us. If we came as Africans, how do we end up as Americans?
Beg to differ here that my ancestors came here in a slave boat. They didn't. They came from the island of Jamaica, and they came on their own because they thought it was a better place to be than Jamaica.
How did they get to Jamaica? They came as slaves to Jamaica. Yeah, I was born in Trinidad.
But
that's where the slave ship dropped them. We're all slaves.
We can't solve this one.
Jamaica. Did you decide to drop in Jamaica? The white man dropped you in Jamaica and brought you to Mississippi.
Right.
So you don't define yourself by the enemy?
No, I define myself as the fighting place is where I'm at. Right. Not where I used to be, or where I thought I was.
So if you're fighting on the slave ships, we fought on the slave ships. Did you call yourself a water?
And you're still fighting in 1989, right here in New York City.
Until Africa is free, we won't be free.
All right, one final practical note, Mr. Winter. You're the only editor here. Mm-hmm. How should the media deal with this? As you can see, there's a debate over the issue. What about newspapers, television, books, magazines? I mean, should they continue to use, Haki said he was going to continue to use both. I mean, what kind of guidance do you think should apply there?
Well, speaking immediately for newspapers, and again, while I don't represent directly the Wall Street Journal here, I can tell you that they have discussed this issue recently and concluded that they will wait and watch to take the general standard of what comes to be common usage among Black people in general, as at least we'll call it now, and moreover among academics and political and social leaders and that sort of thing. And if a consensus appears to emerge, then style changes will probably be forthcoming at our paper. And I believe in fact the New York Times has said similar things, which is about all they can do, because there's something going on there in the community and we don't really know what to make of it. All they want to know is that they really don't want to offend anyone in the end. If it becomes apparent that everybody wants this, then they'll likely go along, although they will use people of color in the media as sounding boards to make the decision.
Charlene. We'll just have to wait and watch and see what happens because we're out of time. Ms. Edlin in Washington, thank you for being with us.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Winter, Mr. Llewellyn, and Mr. Ture.
Africans.